Womack. And to my left is Judge Walker, and to my right is Judge Wallach. And we've got two cases set for oral argument today, another case set for submission without oral argument. The first case, I understand, is ready. The 230 case, I'm going to ask the clerk to call that case. Thank you. Mr. Jones, you may proceed.
May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
May it please the court, my name is Kenneth Jones. I'm here on behalf of AKT Investments. The court has the briefing before it. Before we delve into the specific points of error that have been briefed by the appellant, I'd like to briefly review the concept of this case from the view of the party versus counsel. The court has insightfully requested the supplementation of the record, which includes some motions for continuance that were filed by counsel for AKT Investments. Those motions for continuance reveal that counsel is the one that verified the motions, and that with respect to the first motion for continuance, it was sought for counsel's convenience based on the death of his father. The second one was sought for counsel's convenience so that he could prepare to do a number of things that apparently were never done in this case. I point that out because I want the court to understand that the party in this case has done everything possible to bring this case to trial. That's colored by the fact that the two withdrawal motions that are before the court were filed by counsel who had been paid, the first based on personal differences with the party, and the second based on the disbandment of the firm. Not because AKT fired its counsel, not because it sought new counsel, not because it was dissatisfied with counsel, not because it didn't pay counsel. It was sought specifically by the attorneys as opposed to the party. The third issue that the court has before it is the affidavit that is in the motion for a new trial, signed by the officer of AKT, Mr. Moslami, that details what he did to try to both address this case while it was filed, as well as in the interim period after the withdrawal motions were granted. It reveals that in both cases, he had secured counsel before the motions were even granted. This is not a party that sat around waiting for a new counsel to come along. This is a party that, in the first case, had retained counsel before the motion was even signed, and in the second case, the record of the hearing reflects that he had spoken with counsel, counsel had spoken with his second counsel, and that he had paid that party to represent him. The uncontroverted facts are that he operated on with the understanding that his new attorney had accepted representation in the case until he failed to hear from him, at which point in time he went to the attorney's office and began to demand action, at which point in time he was told the attorney was retiring.
Counsel, if I might interrupt, I think we're familiar with what you've laid out in terms of in the record and what your client has testified to with respect to his due diligence. A question I have, which is the party seem to have had the impression that there is one judgment that can be identified as having been signed before another judgment. The two judgments were file stamped at different times, but the judgments themselves are not timed. How are we supposed to determine which one was the first signed?
Your Honor, I would say that it was when it was entered in the record.
Well, it's not. There's no time when it was. There's no time per se of entered into the record. The district clerk, the district clerk could have had, a stack of documents 12 inches high and was just file stamping stuff. That doesn't tell you anything. So do you know of any way that we can determine that? And if not, what standard are we supposed to use when we have two judgments signed the same day that we can't tell when they were signed?
Well, Your Honor, that's obviously a difficult set of circumstances, and that problem will come up when the court signs two different judgments on the same day, and it goes into the court stack. How is this court going to determine what judgment the court intended?
Yeah, that's my question. How are we supposed to figure that out?
I don't know. I think that from our perspective, the only order that's presented is the order that they appear in the record. That's the only order that we have suggested. Whatever appears in the docket sheet doesn't evidence when either of these orders were signed. It doesn't say, I signed this one, then I signed this one. There's no entry in the orders. So there are two orders that are signed. One appears before the other in the record. And it would be my position that the first one entered is the one that is the first one in the record, as it appears chronologically, is the one that controls.
Okay, if we can't make a determination as to which one it was, do you have any idea what the legal standard is for us to make that ascertainment, other than the fortuity of when the district clerk happened to put a stamp on it?
I do not.
Okay.
The second general point that I would bring before the court's attention, which it's probably well aware of, is obviously that given the fact that the withdrawal motions appear to fail to reference unanswered discovery, past due discovery, obligations of AKT as a party, which the affidavit shows that the party was completely unaware of, there are due process concerns with respect to the withdrawal of counsel in these circumstances. And I understand that given the time frame, that could be too remote for this typical case. But in this case, we're not looking at a time frame that is in the court's file. We aren't looking at a trial date. We aren't looking at a discovery cutoff. We aren't looking at an expert designation deadline. We're looking at past due discovery that does not appear of the record, that is a poison pill for this party going forward until it's addressed. Now, there's nothing in this record that discloses why all these other attorneys that AKT visited with did not accept their case. But it's not inconceivable that unanswered discovery within 30 or 45 days of trial would be an issue that any lawyer would step away from. And that's an issue that we point out to the court now. I think that before we go down that road, we should look closely at 165A, because it's obviously the lowest standard of recovering from a dismissal. The standard is the failure of a party or his attorney was not intentional, the result of conscious indifference, but was due to accident or mistake, or the failure has been otherwise reasonably explained. In this case, there's no evidence that the party delayed. The only evidence in the record before the court is that the party always obtained counsel, never fired counsel, always moved forward with the party's obligations, that he believed he had counsel. If that was a mistake, if it was not, the record before the court is that he had a belief, which is supported by the court record, including discussions with counsel that are referenced in the hearing. There are documents in the affidavit filed by Mr. Moslemi showing where he paid a lawyer to represent him. So it's not a harebrained idea that this is somebody that he had approached about this case that he believed was representing him in this matter, and that he began searching for a new counsel when this person rejected his case. That is a reasonable explanation as to why he was unable to come up with counsel in the time frame provided. There's no question that his case was dismissed, that AKT's case was dismissed because it appeared without counsel. That was in a vacuum. That would be the proper remedy.
In my review of the proceedings, the court at one point said the case is being dismissed and then never made a statement on the record that the court was entering judgment on the merits. Did I miss anything?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would point out that there had been a motion to dismiss previously filed in the case, which the court declined to enter at a prior hearing. So whatever the court entered was the orders presented to counsel at the time. whether that discussion was off the record or not, whether those orders were entered in error or not. That's not in the record before the court. So, returning to 165A, we believe that the failure to have counsel on the date in question was reasonably explained. The party had engaged counsel. They had detailed what they had done in the interim period to get counsel to attend to the case. When they figured out that counsel was not attending to the case, they detailed all the other attempts to obtain counsel prior to trial of this matter. That explains why they attended trial without counsel, at which point in time their case was dismissed, assuming it was dismissed. Under that standard, if the court applies the dismissal standard, then under 165A, the case should have been reinstated with a motion for new trial. This court has previously considered, which we relied on heavily in the briefing, the Polyfelt case, which I think goes into some detail on these matters, and specifically states, proof of accident, mistake, or other reasonable explanation negates intent or conscious indifference under Rule 165A. Some excuse, not necessarily a good one, will suffice. In the interim, or about the time the briefing on this case was being done, the Texas Supreme Court decided in Remarriage of Sandoval, which has subsequently been cited in Texas Construction Specialists, which is a Houston Court of Appeals case. It says, when a motion for new trial presents a question of fact upon which evidence may be heard, the trial court is obligated to hear evidence if the facts alleged by the movement would entitle him to a new trial. And when the factual allegations in a movement's affidavit are not controverted, it is sufficient if the motion and affidavit provide factual information that, if taken as true, would negate intentional or consciously indifferent conduct. And that's a direct quote from the In Re Marriage of Sandoval case. Similarly, the Craddock factors are included. Both parties argue similarly that the Craddock factors are not met based on whether or not there was an intentional, whether or not the failure to appear was intentional or the result of conscious indifference, but was due to mistake or accident. The difference between those two standards in 165A and Craddock don't seem to be substantive, although the case law addressing 165A appears to be more lenient in addressing that matter. We have obviously briefed the granting of the withdrawal as being error on the face, as well as the failure to grant the motion for continuance under the circumstances. But it seems to me that the two standards under Craddock and under 165A are significantly easier to meet under the facts presented to this court. We're not down here asking the court to open up an endless amount of time for litigants to obtain new counsel. But in circumstances where the withdrawal reflects that a party has not been notified of breached deadlines, and where the party has provided uncontroverted affidavit testimony as to its efforts to obtain counsel, the party itself has not sought continuances, while its counsel may have, and the party itself has provided affidavit testimony that it has provided everything that has been requested of it in the interim period, it seems egregious to deprive that party of the opportunity to establish its rights, its legal rights in this case, given Supreme Court precedent, which says we should be deciding matters based on their merits and not based on procedural defaults. I'll reserve the last minute of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Vanacek?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Annette Vanacek. I'm here representing T. Jordan Towing, Inc. And at the outset, I'd like to answer Justice Wallach's question. When the case was set for trial on November 1st, the parties were instructed to file pretrial documents, which included findings of fact and conclusions of law, as well as proposed orders, to make sure they filed their exhibit and witness lists all before trial started. That was done. After the court called the case for a trial on the morning of the November 1st, which was a Monday, the judge instructed me to prepare an order of dismissal, which I did not prepare prior to that time. To answer your question, if you look at the docket sheet for the court, you'll see that the case was dismissed on the 1st of November. When the order I prepared was submitted to the court, and presented, that judgment that had been filed prior to the case coming into the courtroom for trial and the instruction to prepare the order, they were signed on the same day, 11-3-2021.
But we don't know which one was signed first.
No, but the indication on the docket sheet would state that the case was dismissed, and that is the phrase, the exact quote that's showing in the clerk's record.
So do you think it's a, so if I understand you, was the judge's request to prepare an order dismissing the case, was that what he verbally instructed you to do at the trial?
Yes, and that's shown in the reporter's record for November 1st, 2021. I was instructed to do that and did so following the conclusion of the bench trial. With respect to the points of error or the issues raised by the appellant in this case, it's important to remember the standard is abuse of discretion. In this particular case, the only thing of record for which T. Jordan Towing could rebut or provide information on until to respond to the motion for a new trial had already passed. In other words, what the evidence that was submitted all was essentially communications between attorney and client, which normally a party would not have access to. In that situation, again, the abuse of discretion, there's no real explanation of AKT's delay from the time their last counsel withdrew in May of 2021 and the trial setting in November 2021. In fact, one of the attorneys was mentioned at the May 2021 hearing as that Mr. Moslemi had contacted, and the instruction from Judge Chupp at the conclusion of that hearing is, get with your attorney, get back in touch with Ms. Vanacek, let's get this rolling. And that's essentially what happened.
At trial, the transcript makes it look pretty clear that Judge Chupp was telling Mr. Moslemi that since he wasn't a lawyer, he wasn't entitled to be heard, except when he was asked questions.
I understand. He did say that.
How would Mr. Moslemi have been able to make a case since he was there as a non-attorney representative of a corporate entity? How would he be able to make a record with respect to the efforts that he had taken prior to that point in time, assuming he'd wanted to?
He might have been able to testify about another continuance. I don't know. Mr. Jones at the time had made it very clear to the court that he was not able to represent AKT after his motion for continuance was denied. One of the reasons I filed the motion to dismiss for want of prosecution in early October is because I hadn't heard from anybody since we had the May 25th, 2021 hearing. I didn't know if we were even going to be reached for trial or who would be appearing at that point, so I wanted to get that issue addressed.
It's striking, is a good way to put it, to see that a person who has retained a counsel is told by multiple lawyers within the same firm who shuffle him off from one time to the next, to the next, to the next, who then goes to another law firm, a lawyer who accepts his representation, who cashes his check apparently, and then decides to retire, and all of a sudden he's gone. Do you think that's just a stroke of bad luck?
I believe that Judge Chupp was very clear at the hearing on the motion to withdraw that Mr. Muslimi needed to retain, make sure he retained counsel.
He did, Mr. O'Donnell, didn't he?
I don't, other than the evidence that was presented after trial in their motion for new trial.
Okay.
I have no evidence to back that up.
But, okay. But if you don't controvert it, isn't that the evidence that we have in front of us to consider?
It's all that we can.
Okay.
And Mr. O'Donnell didn't controvert either that he wasn't retained. I presume he's disappeared for retirement purposes. But I will note that...
I hope he's not in sunny Florida, but... You know.
No, but I will note that at some point in time in the clerk's record, Mr. O'Donnell's name appeared for some kind of service. I wasn't aware of that until I got the clerk's record for purposes of this proceeding in the Court of Appeals. But there was an email address noted somewhere in the clerk's record for a Mr. O'Donnell, or an M. O'Donnell, I think is who it was. So I don't know if he was in fact retained or had the payments that Mr. Muslimi's affidavit would indicate that he had paid. Nevertheless, it's pretty clear under the cases that were cited in the appellee's brief, 5 months to trial would have spurred Mr. Muslimi as the representative of the LLC to make sure his counsel was retained. In other words, that his attorney had entered an appearance, that papers were being filed and presented to the court for AKT's review. And in that same notion,
you have a case that says that?
That he was responsible?
It's the client's responsibility to see that his lawyer has actually gone ahead and entered appearance and is actively representing him?
Well, I believe at some point Mr. Muslimi suspected that wasn't happening because he had testified in his affidavit. He went and sat at an office somewhere for waiting for Mr. O'Donnell.
Right, but my point is he may have... By that point in time, it may have been very suspect of lawyers generally and was checking up to see if he was doing something, but is there any legal obligation that once he's testified that he's retained somebody, that he then has to do checkups on them to make sure every 3 weeks or 6 weeks or every month that they're actually doing something?
No, but I believe in the ordinary course of attorney-client relationships, you send copies of paperwork that you've prepared to your client and papers that are sent from the other party, and
maybe,
it was
maybe
all
you do, and maybe a lot of lawyers.
Not all lawyers do that. As you say, ordinary course. That may be ordinary course for you, but not necessarily ordinary course for anybody else.
And in that same regard, I had been told I would be receiving responses to discovery that was never sent to me, despite the fact that I had provided it to the initial counsel, Mr. Chidji, to the second counsel that was in the case at the Ross firm, and I anticipated at some point, based on the statements Mr. Muslimi made at the hearing on the motion to withdraw, that I would be hearing from somebody named O'Donnell or somebody from that firm Mr. O'Donnell was with about this discovery. I didn't, and that's why I filed the motion in October when we were told we were on standby for trial, and that's what the clerk's record does indicate.
But you also agree that we have a responsibility to look at whether or not there was abuse of discretion in denying the motion for new trial.
Yes,
I do recognize that. And if the Craddock factors, if any of the three are missing, then it is an abuse of discretion. You agree with that, concede that?
Yes, I understand what the Craddock factors are. It's the appellee's position that it wasn't an accident and a mistake. Mr. Muslimi knew he needed an attorney at that. He had an option, which he chose not to take. He could have non-suited and refiled.
And your position is that it wasn't conscience, you said accident or mistake, is simply because of the amount of time.
That he had from when his last attorney withdrew, yes.
Right. Which he could rebut, obviously, in a motion for new trial.
He could, yes. And he could, and his, he could have presented additional testimony at the court hearing, asking for more time at that, and he did not do that. In this particular case, I believe Mr. Moslemi, from his testimony both at the hearing on the motion to withdraw and at the trial, knew he needed an attorney to represent.
I don't think that's the, I mean, I don't think that's obviously an issue, and I don't think that he didn't think that he needed one. I think it clearly he knew he needed one, and the question then is whether or not he was consciously indifferent in getting that counsel, if it was something that he was doing that was just an accident or a mistake, or not. But then, of course, they do file this motion for new trial and tell their story and explain why, at least their position is, that he didn't do it. I mean, that he didn't have an opportunity to have an attorney actually do what they were supposed to do.
That is true. He did provide those statements, which from the appellee's perspective is difficult to controvert, because, again, these are privileged communications in ordinary circumstances.
Did you seek discovery on that?
I did not on the motion for new trial. I hadn't had very much success in getting discovery responses in this particular case. Nevertheless, I did not
file motions to compel.
I did not, because the penalties under the rules provide that this would be forthcoming information. None of the documents attached to the motion for new trial were ever provided to my client after the suit was filed. Those only appeared in response to the motion, or the judgment being entered or dismissal. They were attached at that point. That was the first opportunity.
What evidence is there in the record to show that Mr. Moslemi was ever given that information to show that he had to have that discovery done and had to have it done by a certain point in time?
The initial motion to withdraw referenced the discovery that was due. In the original answer that I filed on behalf of T. Jordan Towing with his first counsel, I had put request for disclosure in our response. I resent the request for disclosure in, I believe it was in January of 2020, before Mr. Chidji withdrew.
Those are all lawyer communications and lawyer filings. So my question is, what evidence is there in the record that those documents showing a need to respond to discovery actually went to Mr. Moslemi so that he would know, I need to do this?
I don't know what his attorney sent to him, but when Mr. Moslemi was the only email address in the clerk's record for service on AKT, there was not only the discovery referenced in my response to their motions to withdraw, but also attached as part of the motion to dismiss that I filed in October, that there was discovery that had not been answered. There were also certificates of discovery filed when I answered discovery and when I sent discovery. I don't believe they went to Mr. Moslemi on the initial service, but in the response to the motion to withdraw filed by Mr. Ross's firm, there was a reference to unanswered discovery from January of 2020 in that. And Mr. Moslemi participated in the hearing where he objected to his counsel withdrawing, and they referenced the need for this discovery to be answered.
Right.
So earlier you said because this stuff is privileged, it's kind of hard to disprove, basically. But you have to concede also that when these Craddock standards are what they are, in doing a motion for new trial, I don't know what else the other side could have asserted other than in any other way that they could have asserted in any differently. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, I get your position, but anybody in this predicament would have done exactly what they did. Wouldn't you agree with that?
That would be something I would raise, and as I pointed out in my brief, there's also inherent power of the court outside of Rule 165 to dismiss if that's something that the court feels there's been delays and that sort of thing. There's an inherent power that the judge would have absent even Rule 165. So under those particular issues, I think Judge Chutt made it very clear when his Mr. Ross's firm withdrew, hey, get busy, make sure you know that you're represented, get an attorney. This was his last words.
But if what is addressed in the affidavit, what's addressed in the motion for new trial, is true, then do you still believe that it wasn't enough to get him over the threshold?
I think there was still evidence of delay on the part of Mr. Moslemi, only because he recognized at some point Mr. O'Donnell was not representing him. And it's not clear from his affidavit or his declaration when that occurred, but he was aware of what Judge Chupp's instructions were at the end of the hearing on the motion to withdraw. So at that point, I believe he understood he needed to do something.
And that's when he hired current counsel, correct?
No, I believe he hired current counsel after my motion to dismiss was filed in October. So there is a period of time where there, Mr. Moslemi doesn't graphically say on at 2 p.m. on this day I knew, but there is a gap of time in there that is well beyond just 30 days or 45 days, 60 days, whatever, that Mr. O'Donnell was not doing anything, and that the record from the clerk's office shows there was nothing filed after the order entered by the court allowing the Ross firm to withdraw, with the last instructions being get an attorney.
So your position is you filed your motion to dismiss in October early. It was ultimately dismissed on verbally on the 1st of November, and then the order was signed on the 3rd. That's a month at the most. And so at some point in there, you're saying that he wasn't diligent in that. Do you agree and concede that in this world that we live in today, the way attorneys are as busy as they are, that for an individual to try to line up counsel in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, that's not as easy as one might assume?
I'm sure it was very difficult to get appointments or get into where you could confer with counsel. I'm saying, though, that at some point between the end of May and the beginning of October, it was clear AKT was not represented by an attorney. In fact, the trial court's notice of trial was sent out to Mr. Moslemi, and that was sent out at the end of the hearing on the motion to withdraw, notifying him there was a trial coming up.
It was clear because of what Judge Chupp said in court the one time, or?
No, there was an order setting the case for trial entered at the end of May of 2021. So Judge Chupp was reinforcing, this needs to be addressed and you need to make sure you have counsel. It wasn't just a statement out of context. Right after that, an order was sent to Mr. Moslemi because it was his email address in the clerk's record. So, because my time is running short, I believe, as the authorities we've cited in our brief indicate, this delay is not purely explained because Mr. Moslemi didn't realize one or two attorneys that he had talked to weren't going to show up in the case. There is a 5-month span between when Judge Chupp allowed the Ross firm to withdraw and the case gets called for trial. It was 6 months from the time the Ross firm filed their motion to withdraw that they didn't want to be in the case. So there was time, and Mr. Moslemi, even, I believe, in diligence, talked to an attorney and had told the court that he had talked to somebody, and that's when you see Judge Chupp's comment, get that taken care of and have Mr. O'Donnell contact defense attorney. And that was the last statement in the clerk's or in the reporter's record. In short, T. Jordan Towing would ask the court to deny the relief sought by the appellant in this case and uphold the order of dismissal referenced not only on the court jacket or the court notes, but the order of dismissal, because essentially the judgment does the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jones?
I May it please the court, I'll just address a few of the things Ms. Vanacek has brought up. Obviously, we initially began the day talking about the distinction between the dismissal order and the judgment order. There's clearly no basis for a judgment in this case. There was no evidence presented. The record does not reflect that any evidence was received. So that order...
Or does the final judgment.
Right, exactly. With respect to the dismissal, we have talked extensively about whether or not the Craddock standards in 165A have been met. I would ask the court to look very closely at the evidence in the motion for new trial, because I believe Ms. Vanacek has not clearly referenced what was contained in Mr. Muslimi's affidavit, which says that, yes, he knew when the trial setting was. Yes, he believed he had retained counsel. When he had not heard from counsel 30 days plus out, he went and sat in his office. When he was told that he was going to be retiring in, I believe it states specifically in September, which would have been just over 30 days, he immediately began visiting with other attorneys who are referenced in the affidavit by name, at least three or four other attorneys, before he got to myself, who he came to by virtue of a friend who I had represented. So there were a number of other attorneys. There's arguments made that T. Jordan could not have rebutted this information, but the existence of an attorney-client relationship is not attorney-client privileged. Calling these attorneys and asking them, did you represent so-and-so from this date to this date, is not an invasion of attorney-client privilege. None of that was done. There is nothing in the record to controvert that, one, Mr. O'Donnell represented Mr. Muslimi on this, or at least he believes so, through September. Reminder, the standard is not that he actually has an attorney, but that he justifiably believes that he has an attorney. He has paid the man. The man has called about his case. I would ask the court to look closely at the last hearing, because what's very interesting is Ms. Vanacek says, we pointed out in our response that this discovery was past due, but that is never mentioned to the judge at the hearing. In fact, the withdrawing party specifically says everything has been done in this case. Everything, there are no past deadlines, there are no deadlines. Ms. Vanacek doesn't mention the fact that there's this discovery outstanding while Mr. Muslimi is standing there. So the case moves on. I can't say off the top of my head whether or not her response to that motion was served on Mr. Muslimi. I don't know why it would have been, given that he still had counsel at the time, but that's in the record. So whatever it is, there is no evidence that he ever received any of this discovery, other than potentially that service of that withdrawal motion, which I don't believe it shows. I think that Mr. Muslimi has shown that in not just this withdrawal, but in the prior withdrawal, he treated this case diligently. He went and got counsel. He went out. He had somebody who not only had he spoken with, but he'd spoken with sufficiently that they were calling counsel who was withdrawing in the case, somebody that he had paid money to. That is justifiable grounds for believing you are represented in a case. Payment to a lawyer creates that relationship. So his other statements as to when he went and sat there because he knew trial was coming up. He did more than most litigants would do in trying to make sure that his case was ready for trial. And he did more than all these lawyers did in addressing this case. He's shown due diligence. He's shown that this was not due to conscious disregard. And he's entitled to present his case on the merits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to both of you for your arguments. They're beneficial to us, and your case has been submitted now. And I do not see everybody ready to go on the 3:15, so we'll step down and let the bailiff check and see who's here to check in with the clerk's office, and we're ready to go once they're ready to go on the 3:15. Thank